session number 10763, reel 4.
I think that the experience of talking to these people, and that particularly with that Italian gunner, Peluzzi, I think it does underline one thing about the whole of that air battle for Malta. I don't know whether it affected other people, the army and the navy, I doubt it. But I think there was no doubt that it was a very close-knit, sort of intimate thing. We all knew what was going on. I mean, we knew, for instance, what a terrible state we were in those awful times in March and so on. I mean, we knew only about 3 weeks' worth of food and about the same of ammunition. And you see, the only contact really that we had coming into the island, other than transport aircraft, and there were only a very limited number because they were required for other things, there were these two mine-laying cruisers that the Royal Navy had. I mean, the Manxman and the Welshman. These were the two. I mean, they do 40 and 50 knots, those things. They used to go through the Narrows at night and then dock, and then they'd unload, and out they'd go. And they did the most marvellous job. They and the submarines who came in and brought aviation fuel and sort of essential medical supplies and that sort of thing. But I think that the whole thing about it was that one really was a sort of very close-knit family. It was an intimate sort of livelihood, really. And I think that the majority of us thought in March and April, certainly towards the end of April, after that first run with the Wasp and they'd lost all these aeroplanes and things were really terrible, I think that we thought that probably it was only a matter of time before the Germans would invade. And I've talked to Edu Neumann about that, and he said, well, you know, Crete was very expensive as an operation. And I think that the German high command were very doubtful of the sort of support that they could get from the Italians, the Italian fleet, on whom they would have to rely very heavily. And he said, I think that on balance, then of course they got to the point where things were going very badly in Russia for them, and they had to shift stuff from Sicily to Russia. And I think that it was a sort of an accumulation of reasons why they didn't do it. But certainly so far as we were concerned in Malta, we knew everyone, we knew the local people, and it really was a very close-knit affair. We were talking a little earlier about the Maltese people. Now, I had a curious experience, because The Maltese servants in the mess, they were civilians, and the batmen. Now, on the whole, I think they were pretty dishonest, to be honest. I was always very keen on photography, as being a hobby of mine. And I had bought, when I was a journalist, before the war, and I was in America and doing a column from Florida for the Express, I had bought, I think largely on Express expense account, I'd bought a super Kodak camera, which was really a treasure. And I'd taken some excellent photographs of Malta, and one day this blooming camera disappeared. And you know, I talked to my batman and I said, you think any of you know where this camera has gone? And there was always that expression that the Maltese used. If they ever wanted to find an excuse, it was always, my brother from Gozo, senor. And my brother from Gozo. And so anyway, I felt sure he must have known what it was. Anyway, I never saw this camera again. And Norman McQueen, this chap that I've been talking about, we saw Kurt Langer with, He was also very keen on photography, and he had, likewise, he had a lovely, for those days, Kodak Retina camera with a Compa rapid shutter and a Zener lens that had been made in Germany in 1939. And he took excellent pictures with this, and he always used to fly with it in his battle dress, tucked into his battle dress on the left-hand side, hoping that he was going to get a chance of a good picture or something, the aeroplane going down or something. And when he knew that, I knew Norman awfully well, and when he knew that I'd lost his camera, he realized what a terrible blow it was. And he said to me, look, and the adjutant's here, and he can hear this, if anything happens to me, you can have this camera of mine. I don't want it to go personal effects. I think he was sort of slightly fatalistic, Norman. And the adjutant heard it anyway, didn't think anything more of it. Well, then about a week later, he was shot down. And he was shot down from 8 to 10,000 feet and went straight in, and he was killed. And he had this camera on him, and the adjutant, when all his sort of effects were being collected, the adjutant said to me, well, Norman said this, you know, I heard him say it, and I'm sure that he wouldn't have said it, I'm sure that he meant it, and so you must have this camera. Well, I said, you really think that's right? I mean, would you not think that his family ought to have it? Oh, no, he said, I think that that would be quite mistaken. I can remember saying these words. He said, Norman wanted you to have that camera because you're both so interested in photography and you take these photographs. And so I had it. And I didn't use it. But when I got back home, I had a very good friend. He was really a friend of my father's originally, called the first... He became Lord Brabazon of Tara, and he was then Colonel J.T. Seymour Brabazon, and he was in Churchill's coalition. He was a Minister of Transport in Churchill's coalition, and then he made some speech about Russia, and he had to resign. But old Brab, he was such a friend, and he was on the same border I sat after the war. And he'd become Minister of Aircraft Production after being Minister of Transport, or before, I think. And then he'd gone to the House of Lords when he had to resign. And he was a director of Kodak. And I can remember seeing him when I came back. I think he asked to see me or something when he knew that I was back from Malta. And I told him the story, and I had this camera, I've got it there. And I said, do you think that this camera could be checked over? Because, and I told him the story of it, I feel sure it's probably been damaged. And he said, oh, yes, certainly. I said, I'll see that it's sent down to a Kodak's factory. And so it was sent down to Kodak's, and they took the camera apart, and there wasn't a thing wrong with it. And I've got it now, and I still take pictures with it. And it's an excellent thing. But I think the whole sort of ambience of Malta and the battle and the relationship that we had with the other services and so on, It was terribly close, and it really was a very combined thing. I mean, that battle that was fought in those about 10 days, 8 or 10 days, starting on the 9th of May 1942, when the second run of the Wasp took place with the Eagle and all those aircraft came in. You see, they had had a completely new organization to receive these aircraft the second time after this debacle. The first time. I mean, that couldn't happen again. And so it really was, I mean, it was a quite remarkable combined operation which brought in the Navy and the Army as well as the Air Force. And in each of these pens at Lucca, and at, because you understand we had all these sandbag pens to try and preserve the aircraft from the bombing, both at Lucca and at Takali, further north, there was a Malta-trained pilot ready to take over the aircraft when it landed after 3.5-4 hours flying from the carrier. And there were drums. I mean, there was a paucity of bowsers, of petrol bowsers had been lost and so on, but there were hundreds of these drums of fuel. And they were loaded up all round the pen, and ammunition, belts of ammunition. They were all waiting there, and because we hadn't got all that number of Royal Air Force personnel, the Army were brought in and the Navy were brought in. They were all there, ready, because everyone knew, as I say, this close-knit operation of Malta, everyone knew that we were absolutely up against it, and this time the thing really had to work, and if it didn't, I mean, it was probably curtains, because we had to get a convoy in soon, even if they only got just a few ships in. And when they got in, they'd worked it out that with this, and Jumbo Gracie was the station commander at Takali, and he was as much responsible, I reckon, for it as really anyone. He was a very efficient man. He'd been a pilot, he'd fought in the Battle of Britain, and he'd flown with us, but his eyesight was terrible. He should never have been flying. But anyway, I think in the end, the AOC got to understand that his eyesight was bad, and he made him the station commander at Takali, and he was excellent. He was really efficient, got everything buttoned up. And he was responsible, I think, as much as anyone, for this organization, this sort of combined services organization, to turn these aircraft around. And the target was to turn them round within 30 minutes, because normally when these aircraft landed, the Germans from Sicily used to wait about a couple of hours before they'd already take quite a time to build up a raid, bring it in, and then catch all these aircraft refueling on the ground. And that's what happened before in the first run. And so the target was to turn them round in half an hour, 30 minutes. Well, in point of fact, in the actual event, they were turned around in an average of 12 minutes. I mean, it was the most amazing thing. And the moment that they were turned around, they were got off the ground again, so that when the raids came in, ultimately, then, of course, these aircraft were ready for them. They dovetailed the number of aircraft, of course, which took off and were ready to meet the raid when it came in, and then the other ones and so on refueled, took off afterwards and took over from them. But it was a real indication of the combination which existed between the services and this sort of close-knit organisation which saved the island.
Leaving Malta, and just could I just go back to an earlier thing that you mentioned, which was the raid or raids on the Scharnhorst and Gneisenau
yes.
Brest. Can you tell me what you remember of that?
Yes, well, it was. You'll appreciate that these things happened very early in my time. I'd come back from Canada. I'd learned to fly in Canada, which was a marvellous experience, and what that Empire Air training scheme in Canada contributed to victory was known, I suppose, only by the people who had actually been through it all there. And then I'd gone to a operational training unit here in this country, at Debden in Essex. And of course, one of the great difficulties, and you'll appreciate that we had only then had about 150 hours flying, or perhaps 200 hours flying, and one of the great difficulties was that, by comparison with Canada, the navigation here was terribly difficult, because in Canada, except for a period of about 10 days when the snows came at the beginning of the winter in November, you got those, and we were there in September 1940. That's when we got there, and we were there until April 41. And during that time, except for this period when the snows came, and that was fairly rough, you've got these marvellous, clear, crisp days, and you could see for miles. I mean, you could almost see from Nova Scotia to British Columbia. And the navigation was simple, because if you ever got lost, all you had to do was to fly south and hit the Transcontinental Railroad and fly down and have a look at the name of the station on the board, and then you could make your way back again. And so, really, from a navigational point of view, there were drawbacks to it. But anyway, when I got to Debden, and eventually I'll come to the answer to your story, your question. On that northeast side of London, which is in Debden in Essex, in those days, no smokeless zones, and with a prevailing wind blowing all the smoke of London over that sort of East Anglia, Essex and so on area, the visibility was terrible. I mean, you hardly had any horizon. I mean, it just looked as if you were flying in a sort of semi-fog. And I can remember very well, this was a Hurricane OTU. We'd been flying in Canada, we'd been flying Harvards and Yales and things, but no service aircraft, I mean, no operational aircraft, no Spitfires or Hurricane. And I went to this 52 OTU there, and I can remember my instructor. He'd been in 249, the squadron which I was a good command in Malta, in the Battle of Britain. And I'd been at school with him. George Barclay, his name was, and he was killed in the desert time of Alamein. And he was that Barclay banking family. He was a terribly nice person, George. And I can remember him saying to me, he gave me a check out the first day I was there in a master, right at the end of the afternoon. And I remember him saying to me, look, I suppose this was, it must have been about in the early part of the spring, anyhow. The hour never changed, but it was just beginning to get, it was fairly, very late in the day, and the light was just beginning to fade a bit. And he said to me, look, you're all right. I mean, you can fly these aeroplanes all right. You know, there's a hurricane over there on the ground. You might just as well get it over now and do a circuit, and then we'll go and have a glass of beer in the mess. And look, I'll just come over and show you. And of course, he did the thing very sort of superficially. He said, well, that's the undercarriage. You know, you get that up, and that's a turn and bang, and the airspeed, and that's a throttle, and put it back. And it was a thing. Now, off you go, best of luck, or something. And I said, anyhow, I got this blooming thing. Well, so happened that this aeroplane really wasn't serviceable. And when I took it off, to begin with, I couldn't get the bloody undercarriage up. And the radio was dead. And I think that was the reason why it had been put on the ground primarily. But at any rate, when I fiddled around with this on the undercarriage thing, it was quite difficult to get undercarriages up, as a matter of fact, until you've got the knack of it. And when eventually I'd got it up, and I'd got a miles away from the airfield, you know, at that sort of speed, and I started to turn, did a circuit, because he said, just do a couple of circuits and bumps, that's all you need, and go and have a glass of beer. And as I turned round, I looked for the airfield, I couldn't find it. And I thought to myself, well, I don't know. I mean, this is very interesting, because of the blackout. Then it was beginning to get quite dark. And I thought, well, I don't know. I mean, this is, you know, no radio. I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do. And anyhow, I sort of circled for about 5 minutes, and I couldn't see anything. And I thought, well, there's only one thing for it now for me to do, and that is to put the compass needle on east, and I could just about capable of doing that. I'd done very little flying. Just in Canada, 200 hours or something. And so I thought, well, there's only one thing to do, that's it. Put the compass needle on east, climb up to 10,000 feet and bail out when I know that I'm over the sea. And I shall be an air gunner for the rest of the war. And my God, I mean, you know, just my blooming luck. Well, just at that moment, I was looking down and I saw some little funnel lights, which I thought, well, looked as if they were a lead into a runway. And there was just the funnel lights. There was no flower path as such. And it was getting very near to dark, just about dusk. And I thought to myself, well, anyway, I mean, whatever that is, and it may well be a dummy airfield, and they had a lot of them in those days, that's where I'm going. And so I eventually let down, and I got into this thing, and I did a circle, and I could see the funnel lights, and there seemed to be something going on. It was only an airfield, and I thought, well, whatever it is, I'm going in there. And I put the undercarriage down. I was able to get the undercarriage down, and I turned in on the funnel, and eventually, and this was the first time I'd landed a hurricane, and I put it onto the ground, and I never did a better landing in the rest of the war. I mean, it was absolutely perfect, just like a butterfly being put onto the ground, gentle and smooth and slow, and I came to the end of the runway, and I waited, you know, and I thought, oh, Christ, I'm lucky, whatever's happened, I'm dead lucky. And then I saw a chap over at the control tower waving a torch. It was, by this time, it was really, really pretty dark. It was just enough, I had just enough light looking at the funnels going in, just to judge my height. And so I thought, well, anyhow, it must be all right to taxi across there. I mean, I don't suppose there are any holes. He wouldn't be waving the torch. And so I taxied over there, and he was up by the control tower. I saw the outline. And as I pulled up, and he put the chocks under the wheels, and he got up onto the wing, he was a corporal, and he said, good evening, sir. And I was a pilot officer. I was only just recently commissioned. And he said, have a good flight. And I said, oh, yes, corporal, good flight. And then there was a bit of a pause, and I said, by the way, where is this? Oh, he said, don't you know? And I said, well, I only just wanted to check, you know, Corporal. Well, he said, it's Marshall's at Cambridge. Well, I used to play golf at Cambridge, and I can remember Marshall's. I knew Marshall's. We used to go past it to go out to the golf course to learn to play. And so anyway, I thought, oh, God, anyhow, at least I'm down. And Marshall's was about 40 miles away or 50 miles away from Debden, I suppose, where I'd taken off from. Anyway, I rang up old George Barclay, and the first thing he said to me was, Oh, he said, thank you for ringing. He said, is the aeroplane all right? I said, yes, sir, it's quite all right. And so am I. Oh, he said, I'm glad of that. Well, he said, look, you stay there. I don't want you taking off in the dark, he said. And I said, well, you never get me doing that. But he said, the wing commander flying will want to see you at 9 o'clock in the morning, and you better have your hat on. Well, it happened to be John Grandy, who became the chief of the air staff, and he's the chairman of your trustees. Splendid, I've been a lifelong friend of mine, and I can remember when I went to go and see him, and I that evening I went in and had dinner at the High Table in Pembroke, where with the dons that I happen to know, and they, one of them drove me out about 5:30 in the morning at first light, and I got straight back to Devon. I couldn't wait to get back there, and I can remember putting my uniform on and hat on and sort of my battle dress and that, and I was sitting in the anteroom. And John Grand, the wing commander, who I'd never met before, came in, a rather reddish face and that, and he strode through this anteroom into his office, and I thought, oh, Christ, you know. And eventually the PA said, the wing commander will see you. So I went in, stood to attention, saluted, and he said, what have you been doing? Anyhow, I went through the whole. And he thought for just a moment, and the only thing he said was, and he knew I'd been at the university, he said, well, he said, all I can say is, Lucas, that it's lucky for you that it happened at Cambridge and not at Oxford. I've never forgotten it. And I shall see him this evening. He's getting a Polish gong and whatever that one is, I can't remember now. And whenever I see him, I say, well, at least I was at the right university, and we were friends ever afterwards. But the fact was that we were terribly inexperienced, and when I went to 66th Squadron down there in Cornwall, I was very lucky because there was practically nothing going on, and I had a very good first squadron commander called Athol Forbes, who had fought in the Battle of Britain with a Polish squadron. He became an air commodore and died about 4 years ago. And then when he left us, I had Dizzy Allen, who wrote all those books and said that the Royal Navy won the Battle of Britain, and it really turned the Royal Air Force off. And I was lucky with them because I used to fly with them. I flew number two to Athol Forbes. He was very decent to me and used to look after me a bit. And so I learnt a lot in a very short time. Well, then I was made a flight commander in 66th Squadron after 4 months by Dizzy Allen, much before I was ready for it. And I looked in a book once, and I think I'd done 350 hours flying when I became a flight commander, a flight lieutenant. And, well, I managed all right. And then one day, they were starting those bomber command raids with the Halifaxes, I think, and Stirlings, I think it was, that they were having. And they said they were going, because the Scharnhorst and the Eugen and the Neisenau were then in there, in Brett, and they said they were going to have a major effort against these daylight, and we were in the Port Reith wing. We were going to do the escort, not the close escort, but the sort of medium escort. And just my blooming luck, when this operation order came through, something happened to Dizzy Allen. He couldn't fly. I don't know what it was, and he left instructions that I was to lead the squadron. Well, you know, I mean, I'd got, as I say, about 350 hours flying. I didn't know anything about it, and there were some other fellows in the squadron who had much more flying and experience than I had, and I felt simply terrible. I thought, oh, God, I'm leading this, and we went through all the briefing, and I can remember it was about the first time in my life when I couldn't sleep at night. I can always remember it, and it wasn't a first light operation. It was done about in the middle of the day, early afternoon. And so we had all the briefing, and the wing commander flying was a chap called Minden Blake. He had the Port Reith wing, and he went through it all, and he said, now, Lucas, you'll do this, that, and the other. I don't think he realised how inexperienced I was. Anyway, we got the squadron off, and we climbed up there, and we made a rendezvous with the bombers in mid-channel, about 120 miles across from Cornwall across to Brittany. And a lot of sea, like there was from Coldish or Norfolk across to the Dutch coast. And on one engine, you're always listening a bit. And when I got out, everything was all right, got the squadron together and got him in the right position. And then, by God, suddenly I had an oil leak in the air screw, and it started to throw oil all over the blooming windscreen, and then, by God, the radio went, and we had radio silence, of course, going all the way across, RT silence, and then I suddenly realized I couldn't hear a bloody thing, and I didn't know what to do, and it was the most terrible feeling. I mean, apart from the sort of being frightened, being jumped by someone, or being shot at, I think it was the worst experience that I remember in the Royal Air Force in 6 years or whatever it was. And I thought, well, now what should I do? If I waggle my wings and tell the other section leader to take over, that's terrible. I mean, the first time I lead in a squadron, turn back. I mean, I can't imagine it. Absolutely terrible. I can't do that. So anyway, I went on. Now, that was quite the wrong thing to do. I should have motioned to the fellow saying, can't hear, you know, all that, and turned round and gone back. But I just sort of thought to myself, I can't do that. And as luck would have it, we never saw a blooming... Well, I couldn't see anything, hardly, except straight up through the canopy. The thing, I couldn't see anything ahead. And I just simply went on my ETA, and I knew the compass headings, and when we got there, I could see flak and so on over Brest when the bombers were going in near it, and I thought, well, we've got just about the right time, and so on, and then eventually I did a great big wide turn, and we all came back. We never saw a thing, and the wing never saw, the other squadrons never saw a thing, and by a sort of providential piece of fortune, the squadron was in exactly the right place all the way through, and how it was, I mean, it was no, but it was the most terrible feeling, and I can remember when we came in to land, I landed at Pradanuk, actually, because I thought, well, I knew that the rest of the squadron would be landing at Perranporth, where we were, and the others at Port Reeve, so I landed at Pradanuk, because I thought there wouldn't be any other aircraft there, and I can remember when I taxied the thing in, I put it down, all right, landed, and I can remember the fitter getting up and the thing, said, good God, so you've been flying in that aeroplane like that, and I said, yes, and what's more, I haven't got a blooming radio. But it was, anyhow, that was my start, but you see, I was terribly lucky, because if there'd been a lot of 109s there over the target, as they usually were over there, over that peninsula, when they had those ships in, they didn't have a lot otherwise. Lannion and Morlaix, those two fields in the north of the Brittany Peninsula, if there'd been a lot of 109s, we'd been engaged. I mean, I'd have been in a hell of a fix. I couldn't have seen anything or anything. But it taught me a tremendous lesson, that, and it simply, and I used to say to my other pilots, I used to say, if you fellas have got a dead radio, or if you've got something wrong with your aeroplane, there's no question of lack of moral fibre or anything of that sort. I mean, you fellas turn back, because it's no good, you can't, and it was an absolute object lesson. And when I told the squadron commander, old Dizzy Allen, when he came back, I think the next day, I think he had to go to group or something, he said, oh, God almighty, he said, you should never have done that. It's a wicked thing. I mean, appalling. He said, well, you know perfectly well you should turn back and turn, given it to so-and-so. He's quite capable of leading the squadron. I knew bloody well he was quite capable of leading the squadron, much more than I was, in point of fact. But anyway, that area, I was very lucky in 249 in two respects. One, because I had these excellent squadron commanders who taught me, like I had a first instructor in Canada, George Clark, a super chap. And I can always remember when I was doing one of these books, I was doing a